98% pure potato.
98%
pure potato. Chapter 1, context. The final section being called Why Did Account Planning Start in the UK? And if you've listened this far, I'm going to give you a bonus, which isn't in the book, which is some thinking and writing I've done since, thinking about why account planning it was started in the UK. So wait for that at the end of the section. This is an attempt to explain why the UK context was different enough to spark an intellectual movement to hypothesise how advertising worked and to apply that to make the advertising better. The first factor was the resistance of the British to hard sell. Pressure selling was distrusted, just as the US at the height of the Cold War distrusted advertising after they were told in Vance Packard's Hidden Persuaders that it contained subliminal messages. Advertising which used humour or charm was far more likely to be appreciated, whether or not it was effective. David Ogilvy himself, a Scotsman, told American clients that nobody buys from a clown, but here in the UK, he was pointedly ignored. The second factor was education and the drivers for social and personal betterment through self-education. The mass market development of the paperback in the 1930s had led to the general population reading the classics and more widely. There was a familiarity with what in other parts of the world would have been seen as high culture, and a love of linguistic play, which again advertisers and broadcasters took advantage of. And, as we've seen in the previous chapter, public broadcasting was pervasive and influential. Soldiers returning from the Second World War were given the opportunity to go to university, and bright children from right across the social spectrum were given the opportunity to go to university for free, paid for by national grants. Even though universities represented a minority of the national population, barely 5%, the mix of students widened. The result was an increase in bright graduates who came from a wider range of the population, but represented a tiny proportion of it. Only 25,000 in the 1960s and 50,000 in 1970, with men outnumbering women 3-1. There were still questions being asked as to why women needed tertiary education beyond teacher training college. The handful of graduates may not have known a lot about advertising, but they knew how to think and how to argue. In advertising agencies, the copywriters may have come from the universities with English degrees and tried to write novels in their spare time, but the phenomenon of the Northern art director emerging from art school paralleled the arrival of Northern actors in the drama schools, displacing the received pronunciation of actors reared on Shakespeare. Creative departments weren't hiring women, but they were hiring across a social divide. The creative palette was broadening, but the quality and diversity of graduates had broadened too, and the new arrivals didn't feel deferential towards those who had gone before. There was an egalitarianism emerging from the creative agencies in strong contrast to the agencies which had gone before with their directors' dining rooms. Thirdly, the market increase in the volume of research being carried out was not leading to a lack of confidence in research itself. It was suggesting that advertising wasn't working as advertised. The linking of media research to purchase and consumption was raising much deeper questions about what advertising could potentially achieve for a client. Not all agencies wanted to acknowledge this, but the advertising scene after the arrival of Collett, Dickinson, Pierce was ripe for change. Which brings us to the point when our interviewees come into the story. They haven't all been to university, although most of them have. They don't come from upper-class backgrounds, though a few do. They aren't all men, though most are. They buy into the creativity which is moving British advertising centre stage, getting advertising written about in the papers, and British company bosses directly involved in selecting the ad campaigns. But they worry that many of the wildest creative ideas are, to put it bluntly, indulgent and don't connect with ordinary people. They complain that the wall of quantitative research which every agency has to contend with kills most interesting ideas, so that what advertising gets made ticks the boxes but is invisible to most people. Just a few get the idea that advertising is being massively undersold, that advertising is not just a way to empty supermarket shelves the following day, but can be shown to have long-term effects, which make the intangible associations around a company more valuable than the manufacturing plants it owns. Time, then, to stop talking about long-running campaigns and to start talking about advertising that builds brands. There is a wider ferment which took hold at the end of the 1960s and broke in 1968 when these account planning departments were set up. The counterculture wave finally broke in anti-Vietnam demonstrations across the USA, student demonstrations in Berlin, Paris and London, the response to the assassination of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, the uprising which led to the Russian invasion of Prague. The second wave of feminism dates from this year. Everywhere the younger generation announced that the older generation could not be trusted. In Planet of the Apes, which came out in the same year, Charlton Heston instructs a chimpanzee not to trust anyone over the age of 30. While there is no direct evidence that counterculture was driving King and Pollitt, the zeitgeist was suspicious of received wisdom and no longer deferential towards authority and the establishment. This is an attempt to explain why it was in London and not in New York that the account planning revolution started. All agencies use research, always have. All agencies depend on creative thinking. But two agencies in London rejected the either-or of research or uncontrolled creativity and combined them into a more powerful force. And that is the end of the first chapter. But I want to add a postscript to it, a thinking which came out as the book was going to be printed. And that is that Britain became a global power in planning and advertising because of the democratisation of qualitative research when account planning was invented in London at the end of the 1960s. What was happening in America was that there was qualitative research, but it was academic and it was high-end. In Chicago, in particular, close to the agencies, there were departments of academic researchers who were psychotherapy trained, who were experimenting with running creative workshops, but their methodology was elaborate and simply not practical for day-to-day use in agencies. And that thinking was discovered by, amongst others, Stephen King in London. And it was two women in particular in London who were significant in making sure that research was democratized. Judy Lannan, who Stephen King recruited to run the creative research unit at J. Walter Thompson a few months before he started the planning department in 1968, and Karina Lodge, who at Pritchard Wood pioneered the use of converting scripts into keyframes and soundtracks. Now, Karina had never worked at Boaz, Messini, Pollitt, but her model for development research was adopted, although she had already left to start her own company, Creighton, Lodge and Knight. These radical ways of testing advertising, as they called it, allowed creative advertising ideas to get made, just as TV commercials were changing to full colour. And clients became confident to approve ads, which otherwise they would have had to turn down because they didn't look like advertising that had ever been made before. Once it had been shown that customers understood advertising ideas and could decode the brand messages behind them, British advertising had an advantage that they swiftly exported. Jay Chiat, the US advertising maven, described account planning as the best new business tool ever because of the way it brought ordinary people inside the development process. And the development for this kind of research then moved outside the advertising agencies. Mary Goodyear of MBL might rail against Wendy Gordon and her startup, the research business, for, as she said, industrializing qualitative research, but focus groups were here to stay. And a whole research industry in qualitative research grew up to service this new way of supporting marketing. Researchers learned to distinguish between advertising ideas and executions, so an execution that failed in research didn't have to scupper an entire campaign. Likewise, advertising ideas that were mostly right could be tweaked until the underlying creative idea was clear. Now, it's hard to convey how revolutionary were the ideas that came from what became a whole industry, because qualitative research companies used conceptual frameworks influenced by advertising and brand ideas, and this allowed quick turnarounds and creative leaps. And quantitative research, by contrast, was rather unfairly labelled as the what and the who and the how, when qualitative became the apex, answering the all-important question, why? Why is this working? And that is, I think, one of the most significant reasons why account planning started in London. Because unless you can take ordinary people and put them inside the development process, not simply testing something in some quasi-lab situation, but actually participating with it, you don't have the impetus which really created account planning, and which these first two agencies which started account planning, J. Walsh Thompson and Burs Missoumi Pollitt, had from 1968. That's the end of chapter one on context. I hope that has given you interest and might make you want to read the rest of this book, 98% Pure Potato, written by Tracy Follows and John Griffiths.